The Coram Deo Church Community is a missional church rooted in historic biblical Christianity and committed to engaging an ever-changing culture. We hope the message you're about to hear spurs you towards spiritual formation and mission and helps you delight in Christ alone. Thanks for listening.
We have been preaching through the Gospel of Mark for a while, and we are nearing the end. We have just a few more weeks left. And this morning, as you heard Cindy read, we come to chapters 14 and 15. This is essentially the last day of Jesus' life. And this is a story that has been told and retold. Many of you probably saw the Passion of the Christ movie a few years ago, which depicts the events that happen on this day. The challenge for us with a story like this is familiarity. Right? When there's a story that we know or that we think we know, we tend to drift intellectually from the important details in the story. We tend to become callous to the emotive power that these kinds of stories hold for us. And so I want to suggest to you that we cannot afford to drift from this story. If you are a Christian, you cannot afford to drift. You must linger in this text for a while. To get away from this story is to get away from the very bedrock of your faith and practice. If you are in a place in your spiritual journey where you still don't believe, you're still trying to understand God, I want to suggest that you need to linger in this text as well. Often what happens when we're trying to learn about God is we get presented with the sort of summary facts of the story, like some bullet points and some things that we're supposed to believe. And that's okay, but perhaps you haven't considered the historical sort of flesh and blood reality of the death of Jesus. And it holds a power for you that no summary statement can bring. And so all of us need to sort of slow down and linger in this text, to consider it anew. If this story doesn't sink deep into our souls, we will have shallow faith. So I want to spend 2 weeks looking at this text, these two chapters in Mark. And we're going to do it from two different perspectives. All right, first, we're going to do it from an historical perspective. We're going to look through the eyes of the people, the men who seem to be driving the action, and those who are witnesses to it firsthand. And then next week, we'll take more of a theological approach. We'll consider the relationship between Jesus and his Father, and from that context, try to determine what is it that Jesus is experiencing, and why, from his viewpoint, did this have to happen? All right, so that's next week, the theological perspective. This week, I want to sort of look at it more historically, more at face value. And I want us to consider what did these men do to Jesus and why did they do it? I want you to see what they saw in these events. So let me pray for us, and then we're going to jump into the text and try to see this through their eyes. Father, pray that you would give us eyes to see, give us ears to hear you, that by your Spirit, that you would speak to us and meet with us. Help us to engage what might be a familiar story in ways that are fresh and new, not so that we might gain understanding per se, but so that we might gain an encounter with you that would drive us to faith and repentance and worship. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. The story begins where Justin had us last week in Mark 14. It's a couple days before the Passover. A woman comes to Jesus and where he's staying and anoints him with a very expensive bottle of perfume. And Jesus credits her as having prepared him for his death. And when he makes this statement, you know, the events are sort of swung into motion quickly. He predicts Judas's betrayal. He predicts Peter's denial. And what Mark is trying to show you is that Jesus is going to his death. He's going fast and he's going alone. And the next place we find him is in a quiet place called the Garden of Gethsemane, where he has gone to pray. He brings with him Peter and James and John, and he tells them just to stand and be on guard and watch. He goes a little further and literally collapses on the ground under the weight of what is now fast approaching him. And he's there praying. He's wrestling with God about the events that are weighing on him, looming in his destiny. There's a series of exchanges between Jesus and the three disciples. They were supposed to be watching, but every time he came back to them, they were sleeping. And the third time he confronts them, finally he says, "That's enough. The hour has come. the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. And that's exactly what we want to consider today. Jesus in the hands of sinners. When they look up, Judas and sort of a squad of police are coming, and they have armed with clubs and swords. And Judas comes to Jesus and kisses him. This is just a normal greeting, but it was also the sign that would sort of signal to these guys, this is the one you need to apprehend. So Judas kisses him, and the men come at Jesus as if they are coming to detain a violent criminal. They have swords and clubs. It's so aggressive that Peter draws a sword and strikes one of the soldiers, cuts off his ear. I mean, it is a chaotic scene. Jesus is calm. He bends down and picks up the guy's ear and puts it back on his head and heals him. Right? We tend to think of this as sort of a, you know, serene kind of just like detaining Jesus. No, it was anything but that. It was a fight. Men are with clubs, swords are drawn. The disciples fled for their lives. Mark apparently lost his clothes in the fight and had nothing but a white linen cloth around him. And when the soldiers were taking Jesus away, he tried to follow at a distance to see where they were going to take him. And they saw him and they grabbed him, and all they got was the cloth. And Mark is running away naked. This is a chaotic scene in the garden. Even under this kind of distress, Jesus is totally in control. So much so that he literally heals the man's ear who attacks him. You know what the soldiers have to be thinking, right? What kind of criminal, what kind of rebel heals his attackers and goes willingly, submissively into his arrest? Well, they led Jesus to the high priest, where all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes were gathered together. They had convened. They were waiting. This is called the Sanhedrin Council. Let me just give you sort of a rundown of who these dudes are. It's about 70 guys. The guy who sits in charge of them is the high priest. In this case, his name is Caiaphas. Something you should know about Caiaphas: the average tenure of a high priest was about 4 years. Caiaphas had been reigning for 19 years. He was very well respected, very influential and powerful. After the high priest, you have the chief priests and the elders. This is basically sort of the old ruling class of Jerusalem. They're the wealthy landowners. They had leanings towards Sadducean teachings. The Sadducees were basically this group who was associated with leadership of the temple. They had a very strong concern for preserving the temple, at least as they used it. And so these guys were kind of in that camp. It was more of a political party than a religious sect. In addition to the chief priests and the elders, you also had the scribes. The scribes were more in line with the Pharisees. They were a little more of a religious sect. Now, what's interesting is the Sadducees and the Pharisees differed on a number of theological points and philosophical points, but they had one thing in common. They wanted to do away with Jesus. He had caused so much commotion in their world. He had confounded their wisdom on a number of occasions in the temple. He had confronted publicly their lifestyle and their hypocrisy. He was out of control. They needed to do something with him, and the only thing they knew to do was to get rid of him. And so this is the jury that awaits Jesus. And as he walks in, he knows what we know. This is going to be anything but a fair trial. Mark said that their aim was to put him to death. So Mark records this trial in Caiaphas' house in basically three stages. You have sort of a general testimony. You have an interrogation by Caiaphas. And then you have a verdict. So the general testimony is they had been working to gather some people to bring witness against Jesus. And the baseline charge was that Jesus was a false prophet leading Israel astray. See, they had these scriptural warnings about a man who would come and do miraculous things, but who would eventually lead the people away from Israel's God and Israel's law. So here's this man, Jesus, who had done miraculous things. And the question that lingers for them is, well, is he a true prophet or is he an imposter? Now, keep in mind the events that just happened in chapters 11 and 12 in the temple. Jesus was not only claiming some sort of authority over the temple, he was warning that God's judgment was coming and that the temple would be destroyed. So to a group of people who have a high concern for preserving the temple, this did not come off to them as what the Messiah would be like. And so they were led to believe that he was, in fact, an imposter. And they had tried to find testimony to that effect. Now, in the Sanhedrin Council, you've got to have two private testimonies, witnesses, have the same story to substantiate the charge. And I suspect it was just so much hearsay, so many rumors about what Jesus had done and said that in the end, the pieces just didn't fit and they couldn't find two testimonies that matched. And so Caiaphas turns directly to Jesus and he says, hey, what do you got to say for yourself? Do you not hear all these things that people are saying against you? What is all of this? So he's trying to get a confession out of Jesus. And Jesus remains silent. See, by remaining silent, he doesn't allow the court to exploit all the evidence that had been given against him. And so you can imagine this is extremely frustrating for the court and for Caiaphas. Everything had come to a deadlock. But they have their guy. This is their chance. So Caiaphas determines to interrogate him directly. He looks right at Jesus and he says, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? In other words, are you the Messiah? See, the Jews had this expectation that the Messiah would give proof of his identity. Right? And to them, a man who had been imprisoned, abandoned by his followers, helplessly delivered up to his enemies, this presented an impossible conception for them that he could be the Messiah. And so when Caiaphas asked this question, it's not genuine. It has sort of this rhetorical answer of, no, you could not possibly be the Messiah. Now, remember the Jewish expectation of what the Messiah would be. They had fixed their hope on a man who would come from God, a sort of political revolutionary leader. And so when they're asking this, they're saying, are you the man sent from God who will deliver Israel from its oppressors? Do you claim to be the Messiah sent from God? Now, claiming to be the Messiah was not illegal. It might have been ridiculous or dangerous, but certainly not a capital offense in Jewish law. And so here's what Caiaphas is getting at. Caiaphas and the court, they know that if someone were to claim to be a king of some sort, which is their conception of a Messiah as a political king leader, and if someone claimed that and the Romans heard about it, they knew that there could only be one conclusion. Death. That person would be put to death under the charge of treason. And so this is what they're trying to stir up. This is what they're trying to get to in his line of questioning. And this, at this point, is when Jesus broke the silence. And in doing so, he incriminated himself on the political charge. He says, yes, I am. But he goes much further than that and begins to describe the deeper meaning of his messiahship. He says, yes, I am the Messiah. But I am much more than that. And this is what he says. You will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. Meaning, I'm not just a political leader. I am the final, ultimate judge. These two, the sentence he takes are two prophecies brought from the Old Testament. They carry with it an incredible punch. What Jesus is saying is, yes, I am a true prophet and what I said about the temple will happen. Yes, I am the Messiah, and you will see me vindicated. I will share the throne of God, and I will be the final judge. It's an outrageous claim. I mean, it's outrageous. They, in the court, are utterly offended at the notion of anyone, much less this man, sitting in authority and judgment over them. What kind of Messiah makes such an outrageous claim and does nothing to back it up? They put a sack over his head and they start hitting him and they say, prophesy. Huh? If you're a prophet, tell us who's hitting you. I mean, the court is going nuts. The judges are spitting on him in the middle of a trial. Everyone condemns him as deserving death. The chief priest had ripped his clothes. He is in utter outrage and grief at what has happened here. The court was enraged. But they were also satisfied. Now they had a basis to present Jesus to the Romans as a political king, as a rebel. And they had a basis to present Jesus to the Jewish people as a blaspheming false prophet. They had him right where they wanted him. Under Roman rule, a Jewish court could not put anyone to death. Only the Roman provincial governor had that sort of power. And so the session in Caiaphas' house ends with the final decision to deliver Jesus up to the Roman court. and that they would charge him with high treason. So Jesus was bound and led through the city from the quarters of Caiaphas' house to Pilate's court. And in Roman custom, the trials usually began right after sunrise. That's why the Sanhedrin had tried Jesus through the middle of the night. If they had waited till the morning to examine him, they wouldn't have gotten to Pilate in time. Remember, the feast is coming up. Time is short. This trial in Pilate's court begins with Pilate directly asking Jesus a question. And Pilate will ask three questions in this trial, and that sort of frames the order of how this thing goes down. The first question is to Jesus. Are you the king of the Jews? Now, king of the Jews to Pilate did not mean Messiah. This is not a theological question. Pilate could care less about Messiah. All Pilate wants to know is, are you a political leader? Are you a threat to Roman power? That's what Pilate's concerned about. The charge of blasphemy doesn't even come up in this trial because it doesn't matter. Jesus responded to Pilate, well, that's what you say. Which is great, just really vague, intentionally so. I think what Jesus is saying is, well, yes and no. Yes, I am the king of the Jews, and no, not like you think. And so he just leaves it vague. Pilate, dumbfounded, right? At this point, the chief priests can see a stop in the momentum, and so they start hurling on and piling up all kinds of charges against Jesus, which leads to Pilate's second question. He turns to Jesus, just as Caiaphas had, and says, hey, well, what do you have to say for yourself? Do you not hear all these charges they're bringing against you? Do you have anything to say in your defense? And again, Jesus remains silent. And Pilate is amazed. He has never seen anything like this. What kind of revolutionary doesn't deny the charges brought against him? Or at least take advantage of the opportunity to sort of publicly get his agenda out there? This is no revolutionary. Pilate was at a loss for what to do. Jesus doesn't deny the charges, and he doesn't certainly come off as an insurrectionist. But at this point, the crowd that had gathered began to implore Pilate, hey, let go one of our prisoners for us, since it's the time of the feast. Apparently this was a tradition that they had. And so Pilate says, well, yeah, would you like to let you have this Jesus, the king of the Jews? And when Pilate presents Jesus to the crowd, he's presenting him as a candidate for release. He doesn't find any fault in him. In fact, he suspects that the chief priests brought him there just because they were envious of him. To Pilate, this whole thing seems to be based on some trumped up charges. And so he says, would you like me to release to you the king of the Jews? Now, the high priests weren't going to have this. They're in the crowd and they're stirring up the crowd. They're probably reminding them of the things that Jesus said about the temple, of the outrageous claims that he had made. You sort of get this momentum, and it becomes like a mob mentality. And so they say, no, give us Barabbas. Now, Barabbas is a true insurrectionist who had committed murder and was being detained. Why would they want Barabbas? I don't know. I suspect that at least they know who Barabbas is. At least they think they can control him. If he gets out and does his thing, they can stop him. They've done that before. But Jesus, he's out of control. We don't know what to do with him. Crucify him. Pilate says, well, if you want Barabbas, then what should I do with this Jesus, this king of the Jews? And their yell was, crucify him! Pilate tries to point out Jesus' apparent innocence in this deal, but the yells get louder. There is momentum, and they are yelling, crucify him! Crucify him! Crucify him! And it is blaring. And Pilate is, you know, he can't afford to have a riot on his hands this close to the feast. Right? So to appease the crowd, Pilate gives Jesus over to be scourged and delivers him over to be crucified. Now, if you're reading this, you're thinking, what? How could this happen like this? How could this go down so quickly? This doesn't seem fair. And what you have to keep in mind is that this is not a big deal in the Roman court. Right? They crucify people all the time. Jesus is no more a threat to them than the hundreds of other rebels that they had crucified before. The priority in this court is not justice. It's keeping the peace. Pilate is just trying to cover his own back. From Pilate's court, the soldiers led Jesus away inside the palace. Once they got him in the palace, they began to scourge him. A Roman scourging was a brutal, brutal beating. They would strip a guy naked. They would tie him to a post. And they had this instrument that was basically some leather strands with pieces of bone and metal tied to it to form a chain. And they would literally, one after the other, just beat the dude until like his flesh was hanging from his body, literally. It was grotesque. It is the most perverse form of punishment you could ever imagine. Often, men who were sentenced to crucifixion would die in this beating before the crucifixion ever came. It was awful. And Jesus just takes it. He doesn't say a word. So the men beat him. They take him into the palace and they're sort of tossing him around to each other. They put a purple cloak on him because that's the color of royalty. They take a crown and make a crown of thorns and they stick it on his head. I mean, they're laughing at him. They're mocking him. They're striking him in the face and spitting on him. They're kneeling down and they're saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" I mean, the guy's beat senseless, but he is not even human to them anymore. There is utter contempt and malice for Jesus. Jesus says nothing. What kind of king takes abuse from barbaric men like this? When they were done beating and mocking him, they led him out to be crucified. They summoned a guy named Simon who was just passing through to carry the cross beam of Jesus' cross. Jesus was no doubt too weak to carry it. At the third hour, they put him up on the cross. They hung a plaque above him that said, "King of the Jews." This was the offense for which he was being sentenced to death. They hung two insurrectionists on either side of him. The picture is Jesus is dying a death that belongs to violent rebel criminals. The soldiers below, they had divided his garments and they're just throwing dice to see who would get them. This to them is just business as usual, nothing special. The people who are passing by are shaking their heads and saying, "Oh, you who would rebuild the temple in 3 days, why don't you come down off the cross and save yourself? Let's see what kind of power you really have." The chief priests are gloating in their victory. They're mocking Jesus, not to his face. They're turning to the people around them and they're saying, this Messiah, this God who can't save himself, let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now off the cross so that we might see and believe. Jesus was not just being killed. He was being shamed. Crucifixion was the cruelest and most degrading form of punishment ever conceived. And this is what happens to Jesus in the hands of sinners. Secret arrest. False testimony. Private beating and mocking, public shame and death. All of Jesus' claims became worthless on the cross because of his weakness. How could this be the Son of God? If God were with him, God would protect him. God would deliver him. This is ridiculous. That's the thought that's going through their minds. And I have to imagine that some of them were quite confused. I mean, they had seen Jesus do incredible things, raise people from the dead even. But now he does nothing. Why? What kind of deliverer will save others but won't save himself? There's a theme running through the narrative of Mark's account. And it's a theme of mockery. in the Sanhedrin council, Jesus is mocked as a false prophet. In the palace, he is mocked for his pretensions of kingship. He is stripped naked, which is utter shame. They mock him as the king of the Jews. Those who are passing by mock him. The chief priests mock him. Even the criminals dying on the crosses next to him mock him. What is Mark trying to say to us in all of this mocking? I want to suggest just two things. First, the human response to the claims of Jesus is usually resistance and even hostility. The magnitude and the exclusivity of what Jesus claims about himself stirs up some hostility in all of us. We don't like to be forced into an all-or-nothing decision. And that's what Jesus presented them with, and that's what he presents us with. If he's God, we either lose our life or we keep it. See, you can't just sort of like Jesus. You know? I mean, if you think Jesus is a pretty cool guy and you kind of like him, think he's probably a good thing to add to your life right now, you have got the wrong impression about Jesus. Jesus claimed to be God. He is saying, I made you, and you will answer to me for your life. I am your judge. You can't just kind of like him. You have to adore and worship him, or you have to despise and reject him outright. And we don't like that set of choices. We want to rule at least some part of our life. And when Jesus comes near claiming to be the true master, we resist him. See, the irony in their mocking is that sinners are standing in judgment of the judge. We assume the throne of our life, which is rightfully belongs to Jesus. Second thing we see in this mocking is that our sin blinds us to the weakness of God's ways. See, Jesus, on one hand, is always great in his claims, but on the other hand, he is weak in his ways. He remains silent. He gives no defense. He takes the beating. He is led. Everywhere in this text, he is led, and he goes like a sheep led to slaughter. When we don't know something, when we don't understand something, our tendency is to scoff at it, especially if we think it's weak. When we don't understand what God's doing or why he's doing it, we tend to hold him in contempt in our court of judgment. You see, the irony in the story is that while they're saying God could not possibly be saving the world through this kind of weakness, God is doing just that. They missed the most incredible display of God's power simply because they could not fit his method into their small perspective. Their sin blinded them to it. And so when we look at the story in Mark 14 and 15, and we look at it through the eyes of these sinners, what we see is our own hearts. We see how we resist Jesus' claim to every part of our life. We see how our sin blinds us to the ways that God demonstrates his power in weakness. We are them. When you come to the end of this text, it gets bizarre and really fast-paced. In six verses, here's what happens. Darkness covers the earth in the middle of the day. Jesus lets out a sudden yell of anguish. There's a bizarre misunderstanding among the crowd that he's calling out for Elijah. Jesus breathes his last and dies much, much sooner than anyone expected. And then the curtain of the temple is torn in two from top to bottom. And Mark is piling these details on one after the other, and the pace and the intensity is really picking up now. And everything is leading up to this remarkable remark made by the person from whom you would least expect it, the Roman centurion soldier who is sitting at the foot of the cross, who is presiding over this crucifixion. when he sees how Jesus died and he hears his cry, he says, "Surely this man was the Son of God." Mark is using the centurion to show us what this means for people. Even this guy. I mean, this is a Roman thug. He had seen and inflicted murder and death to brutal degrees. Furthermore, the only person about whom a Roman would say, "This is the Son of God," would be Caesar. Anything else would be treason. Yet when this man sees how Jesus died, his verdict is, "This man was the Son of God." Can you see what the centurion sees? That this is no ordinary death. Usually when men are crucified, they go through long periods of exhaustion and unconsciousness before they die. Mark records a sudden and violent death. Jesus is conscious to the very end, and he yells out this loud yell of anguish. And the strength which he possesses at the moment of his death leads the centurion to say, "This is not the death of an ordinary man." Can you see what Mark's readers see? The curtain of the temple is torn in two from top to bottom. This is God's way of saying, "This sacrifice ends all sacrifices. The barrier is gone. Anyone can come into my presence now." In the hands of sinners, Jesus is treated with total irreverence and brutality. What does Jesus do with these sinners? He heals them. He prays for them. He forgives them. He dies for them. At once, Jesus is living the life of compassion and obedience that we should have lived. And he is dying the death of punishment and judgment that we should have died. All for us. All in our place. If you hear his cry, if you see how he died, it will penetrate the hardness of your heart just as it penetrated this hard Roman soldier. You will quit trying to run your own life. You'll quit trying to fit God inside your agenda. If you will just see, you will be stunned, amazed. You will worship him. Listen, it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what you've done. There is now mercy for you. I want you to look and see what the centurion sees. Pilate found no guilt in him. Jesus dies in the place of Barabbas. The innocent man is crucified so that the guilty can go free. This is what they see. This is what Mark wants you to see. Jesus died in your place. Stop judging yourself. Stop hiding behind the judgment that you feel from others. Jesus was judged in your place. You can go free. The curtain of the temple has been torn from top to bottom. Anyone can now come in by faith in Jesus because God has made a way on his cross.
We hope you've enjoyed this message. For more information about Coram Deo, visit our website at cdomaha.com.